This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from BFM 89.9. I'm Meera Sivasudhi. Now, after 8 years on the air, we're bringing the Bigger Pictures Health and Living to you, live, on the ground. A whole day with the experts, debunking myths behind heart disease and diabetes, addressing our love affair with food, and of course, George will be there talking about sperm. So join us at BFM's Health and Living Live 2016 on Saturday, 2nd of April. Go on and register at bfm.my/health.
Well, talking about reducing costs, app-based car sharing, systems have reduced costs for commuters using, as it were, taxis, because this has made taxi drivers unhappy. They're stuck within a certain structure, and they led some protests yesterday out in Bukit Bintang, causing a two-hour massive jam and leading to at least five members of the protest being arrested.
And I think the major frustrations come against ride-hailing apps like Uber and GrabCar. The protest is much smaller than that of the Jakarta last week that we saw. Of course, Jakarta's cab protest a little bit more violent. It have even attacked fellow cabbies who actually worked the day, but that happened in Jakarta. For KL yesterday, it's a lot calmer, but they are asking the SPAD to actually regulate rideshare services. Now, we have spoken to the chairman of the SPAD, Tan Sri Syed Hamid Alba, and they want to see more, they want to see more of these vehicles to actually be regulated, and they don't have the ability or the rights to actually carry these, pick up these passengers. And of course, I think SPAD has a lot to say about this as well.
So this is Tan Sri Syed Hamid Alba explaining the position of SPAD in terms of regulating rideshare services.
One of the things that we have found is that why they do not like to use meter is they consider that the fare is very low, then it is difficult for them to earn a living. But when you don't have maintenance costs, you don't have the cost of renting or hiring a vehicle, you know, many of the issues that we are trying to sort out, we need to sort out this. We cannot just leave it as it is. You know, I think trying to get Uber license, it's not a question of Uber being licensed. It's a question of how do we get the private vehicles to be part of the service.
That is Tan Sri Syed Hamid Alba explaining the position of SPAD on regulating rideshare services.
So the bigger question right now is actually who owns the cab companies, because cabbies pay day rates on these ownership of companies, and these rents that they pay is putting a big pressure on them to actually earn at least a basic minimum revenue per day. So these kind of pressures are actually making the cabbies beholden to the owners. Now, I'm pretty sure there are many cabbies actually listening to us right now. If you want to chime in and give your views, please text us at 016-2-01-9000, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. Following back to these kind of reasons why people want to take up rideshare services, the Star actually carried one case study examining the life of a 28-year-old who has a day job working in an oil and gas firm. His take-home pay is 3,000 per month, but earning side income of over 4,000 ringgit per month just by driving Uber shows that his side income can be bigger than his day job. So this motivation of getting more money with lower regulation allows for this greater growth of Uber drivers and GrabCar drivers as well.
Yeah, but you know, Ibrahim, I take these, I take taxis, I take a GrabCar as well. But what I've been speaking to these drivers, yes, initially there were high levels of incentives for those entering into the service, but those incentives have dropped. In fact, those driving have to drive longer hours to make as much as, those who had entered maybe 9 months ago. So things are changing even within that market, and in terms of the incentives for people to, take up this job. I do think it interestingly enough, what GrabCar and all these other options are available. I mean, they're great for the consumer, but they also provide an outlet for people who have lost their jobs. And so it's something that you can get into very quickly without, having to jump over or through many hoops, bureaucratic hoops.
Yeah, I'm wondering whether this is a zero-sum game. One has to win while the other has to fail. I think the Klang Valley Taxi Driver Association president rightly puts it up, saying that these GrabCar and UberCar rideshare cabbies actually make it difficult for taxi drivers to make a living. And I think this conversation will go on for a longer time.
Yeah, moving on, Zakaria Arshad has been appointed the new CEO of FGV.
And of course, we've heard this rumour flying for some time now, and FGV has confirmed that Dato' Zakaria Arshad has been appointed as the new CEO of FGV beginning April 1st. Now, Tan Sri Muhammad Isa Samad, the chairman of FELDA, said that with this new appointment, FGV will continue to strengthen its position. Now, this is, you know, let's re-examine back the life of Amir Mavani during his tenureship as the CEO of FGV. When FGV started out, that was one of the biggest IPO that was done for that year, even rivaling that of Facebook. Facebook was the largest, they were the second largest. This is put in context, right? And in 2015, the revenue actually dropped from 2014. This is also reflective of how share prices actually dropped. They've shed billions of dollars in terms of market capitalization year on year from 2014 to 2015. And 2016, the market cap is still shedding still. Now, EPF, one of the largest shareholders when they started off, also reduced their stake. They started off with close to 6% in 2014. Right now, they hold to about 5%. So I guess these kind of loss of confidence can be reflective of how FGV was run. And I think with the new leadership of Zakaria Arshad, we're going to see some new changes in FGV.
So the question is, who is Zakaria Arshad? Well, we understand that he holds a Bachelor's of Social Sciences and Economics from University of Science Malaysia. He's attended executive business courses in Harvard Business School, Pembroke College, Cambridge University. He himself, interestingly enough, is a son of a settler from Felda, Palong 1, or Palong 1, Negeri Sembilan. And he's also currently, I believe, the vice president, or vice chairperson, rather, of the Palm Oil Refiners Association of Malaysia, and sits on the Malaysian Palm Oil Council Board of Trustees.
So this is a boy, a settler that has come good to his name. He rose from the grassroots and now leading Felda. And of course, Malaysia is a very strong commodity country. We know that Malaysia and Indonesia together collectively produce about 90% of the global palm oil business. So for him to actually understand how is it like growing up as a settler, perhaps put into contrast how he wants to run a company to actually benefit the people.
So is the market looking positively at this news?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. We will see in about 9 o'clock what happens then. But right now, if we can actually speak of just one problem that Amir had throughout his tenureship of FGV, it's actually with the Eagle High Plantation purchase. We've had him on the grill last year, and we've asked him and examined him over and over again from the various deals that came from this, the high and expensive deposit that was placed, the problems of the ringgit that was fluctuating because the deposit that was placed on was placed in US dollars, so it's actually translated to higher ringgit. So I guess this is going to see more problems for FGV. Now, perhaps they can move on from this problem, but I don't know whether Zakaria will put an end to this FGV matter, sorry, this Eagle High matter.
You're still here. Good. Now, if you're listening to this podcast while on the treadmill, you're already off to a good start. If you're not, don't forget to join us at BFM's Health and Living Live 2016 on the 2nd of April. Find out how you can live a better, healthier life. Go on and register at bfm.my/health.
Okay, we're moving on to Sunway Berhad Property is living up to the adage, it takes two hands to clap, by providing financial assistance to buyers of their own products in the form of three funding packages.
So the mechanics of this purchase is that buyers make an initial down payment of 3%. With the remaining 7%, you can take a loan from Sunway. Once you clear the 10% payment over a period of, say, 12 or 24 months, buyers can now then opt for the 90% loan. Now, this is something quite similar to what other developers are doing. One of them is Selangor Dredging. We came across the news about 2 or 3 weeks ago. Selangor Dredging argues that to make things better affordable, you just make a 5% down payment, and the other 5% down payment you paid as a rent over a course of 36 months. After the period of 36 months ending, then you can apply for a loan, that 90% loan. So I guess developers are taking it upon themselves to become financing companies and fund these houses and put them into the buyer's hands.
Are there moral hazards associated with this kind of structure? I mean, if you are funding, if you need to find a funding for the people who want, you know, your buyers of your products, are you likely to lower the bar on who can buy? I mean, are you going to be getting yourself into all kinds of trouble? Because down the line, they might not be able to sustain those purchases.
No, you're right. You're hitting the mark again, Sharad, which is interesting as well in its own right. Now, this business of not making making houses affordable is a big problem. Now, are houses priced expensive? The answer is yes. Do you need to bring the prices down? Also yes. But the fact remains that we are over-leveraged, we are making loans upon loan. This is considered double loan because you're already thinking of that 90% loan financing. You also have to focus on that 10% down payment. You also have to take a loan for that. Essentially, you're borrowing 100% of that house outright, and I don't know whether that's a good idea. When you can't afford something, the best way to do things is just not to buy it.
Yeah. Also, in Sunway is also in the news for other things, an award of $1.2 billion for an MRT project, as well as it plans that it has to double more properties. Moving on very quickly, Indonesia unveils a port reform. So Indonesia's chief economics minister, Sofian Jalil, announced new reforms to reduce import clearance time from 4.7 to 3.7 days at Indonesian ports. Is it going to complement the push for infrastructure development that President Joko Widodo is, going all out on?
So, of course, Indonesia wants to make trade a central economic driver for growth. This is part of the Big Bang procedure by the President, Jokowi. And I think Indonesia wants to compete with Singapore and Port Klang in the region. If you compare against the TEU, so the number of containers moved within the regional areas, PSA, which is in Singapore, actually moves about 30.6 TEUs annually. Compare that against Port Klang, which is 11. So we're still far behind Singapore. But Tanjung Priok, which is one of the more bigger ports in Indonesia, which is located in Jakarta, moves only 6.4. So they're very far behind in that area. Now, when you think about Indonesia, you want to think about trade. And I think one of the core businesses that they need to fix is this container movement in their ports. Whether or not they can do it remains to be seen, because bureaucracy will cripple the way you do business in Indonesia. And I think hopefully the minister and the president will be able to fix this.
I mean, even in India, right, Narendra Modi hoping to turn that extraordinary coastline into opportunities in terms of ports, thinking about rivaling Singapore, also problems associated with the bureaucracy there.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.